Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host today. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone from the literary world. My guest today is author Gary Bollock. Gary has just published a fabulous novel, Angel's Oracle. Gary, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here, Simon. Thank you very much.
Now, I should point out that I'm one of those pesky people that just has an inquiring mind. So I'm wondering if maybe we could start with a little background. Who is Gary Bollock? Should I be scared of him if I bump into him at the supermarket?
Oh, not at all, not at all. I was born and raised in North Carolina. Grew up in a town just outside of Winston-Salem, North Carolina, which is famous for cigarettes mainly, and underwear, Hanes hosiery. Graduated high school here and was lucky enough to win an AFS scholarship and studied for a year in Paris. I lived with family there, went to Lycée there, and then when I returned to the States, I went to Wake Forest University, majored in French, and was lucky enough to study with, at that time they had a world-renowned scholar who was a contemporary of Jean-Paul Sartre and Camus. Her name was Germaine Blay. And she was very instrumental. She was very supportive of my writing. And so, I took several of her courses, and she became sort of my mentor afterwards. And she was actually the first one to read some of my manuscripts. And she was, again, very supportive. And from that point on, I said I had to find a way to make a living to support my writing. So I drove a taxi for a while, then I waited tables. And then at that time, in the early 80s, Piedmont Airlines was hiring. So I had been told that once you had a secure line of time, you had plenty of time off. And so sure enough, that was the case. And so it was like having a part-time job with full-time pay. So from that point on, I've written all my days off. And Angel's Oracle is actually my second novel. I had one novel come out, but unfortunately, my first publisher went belly up shortly after it came out, so hopefully I'll see that reprinted at some later date. But that's basically where I am right now. I have a lovely wife and two sons. They're grown now. And so if you meet me on the street, no, I'm love to sit down and talk with you sometime.
Right. Now, I didn't realize that you had a first book, and you're not the first author I've talked to that has had the problem of, oh, I got this great publisher, trouble is,
belly up. Exactly. I was all excited. They weren't real honest with me about their financial, bottom line. And it kind of torpedoed my career for about 7 or 8 years because Angel's Oracle is actually under contract with them. And so I, had to wait for them to, go to court and all the rights have to revert back to you. So it kind of pushed my career back a few years, but now it's, hopefully it's back on track. And I'm hoping that people will read Angel's Oracle and enjoy it. And I would imagine they would love the first book because it's very similar in nature. It actually goes back, it's set in the 20s in the South, whereas I'm actually working my way up through the 20th century. The first book was 1921. This was in Angel's Oracle in 1959, and the book I'm working on right now is in present day. So I'm kind of, catching up, so to speak.
I thoroughly enjoyed Angel's Oracle. And I'm wondering if, without giving away any spoilers, because if you do, I will reach through the phone and strangle you. Could you possibly share a little bit about the plot line?
Well, the idea was the idea of the Oracle It's a rock formation. It was actually almost like a lucid dream. And whenever I have an image that sticks with me, I usually know that it's going to make a story, either a short story or a novel. And this one persisted. And I studied quite a bit. I was a big fan of Carl Jung and his work on the archetypes. And so this, to me, was just the perfect archetype. And so it combined history, religion, several things. And so it became essentially the blueprint. I start the novel off with a short myth of free will and about the rebellion that paraphrasing or evoking Milton's Paradise Lost. And the twist is that when Lucifer comes and wants to start a rebellion, there are four angels who refuse to join the rebellion, but they don't want to also stay in heaven. That's the first act of free will. And so they're cast out into the winds, and I'll speed up here a little bit, but in order to leave their mark, they create the four seasons and bore four slits into this tongue-shaped rock formation. And the legend has it that if you can decipher the wind as it blows through and creates the music, you'll know the knowledge before the fall of man that predates really paradise itself. So that was the blueprint for then how do the whites look at this, because this marker is on an old plantation in the fictitious town of Angel, Mississippi. And so the whites call it Angel's Oracle, and the blacks call it Moses' Rock. And that's where I'm getting to, like, the blueprint. So you immediately have a dual storyline of how the whites perceive religion, business, and relationships, and the blacks do. And so throughout the story, then, you have this basically not only a mythical conflict, but a very real conflict that takes place in 1959, which is roughly 5 years before the Civil Rights Movement in the United States. And the reason I did that was to show that between 1859 and 1959, not a whole lot had changed, and then hopefully the reader will see that, well, have things changed that much in present day. And from that point on, I don't want to give away too much, but it's also an exercise in tribalism. You see how each group sort of projects their own not only conscious but unconscious hates and desires on the other group. And then I flip it over and show by making the main character almost a quasi-albino or a Nordic character. And yet he feels more at home with blacks than he does with whites. And so I'm constantly trying to kind of flip over preconceived notions of what racism is about, religion, tribalism. And they literally manifest themselves in most prominently in the sheriff of the town, who is split right down the middle, which, again, like I said, I don't want to give away too much because I think the reader will enjoy it. But it does resolve itself in a very interesting but I think a very prescient way, which has a lot to say about what's going on in America today. So
I think that is actually quite a good summary of the book. In fact, I got to share a story with you.
Okay.
Earlier this morning, and I do live in Mississippi.
Oh, okay.
I was sat out on my front porch, which is my my favorite reading, writing, and thinking spot, and I was just idly jotting down some notes, actually, for this interview. And I just could not shake one particular memory. I'm pretty certain that two friends and I were in Angel a few months ago. I was actually covering a missing persons case, although in my opinion, I think it's more of a homicide than a missing person. And so it's a sleepy Sunday afternoon, and we decide to do what journalists do, you know, snoop around the town and take some pictures. Well, I am by no means a psychic, but I was getting this distinct feeling that maybe, just maybe, we were attracting a little bit too much attention.
Oh, okay.
So I suggested to my fellow travelers that we beat a hasty retreat. All right, which we did. we beat the retreat across the state line, and it wasn't 30 minutes later that we received a phone call from one of the sources that we had in the area, and the message was. The town police chief had basically got himself out of bed, was incensed, and had dispatched two cars to scour the area to find out what the hell these interlopers were doing.
Wow. It's like right out of the book.
Right. Doesn't it just remind you of Angel?
Very much so. Wow. It's almost like, you know. A new chapter you could add to it. That's interesting. Wow.
Right.
Things haven't changed, have they?
No, they haven't. And I think it probably goes without saying that we've decided that we'll just do our investigating from the other side of the state line.
Wow.
Yeah,
I was like,
yeah.
That's interesting. Like you were listening in on one of my dreams here when I was writing it. That's interesting. You know, that's like right out of the book. You know, so wow.
Well, as I said, I just couldn't get the memory out of my mind. You know, I'm going, no, I've got to interview Gary. You know, stop it. Make this memory go away.
Wow.
And actually, on that subject, where did the idea of Angel's Oracle come from?
As I was alluding to, earlier.
I mean, not so much the you know, mythology part, but you know, joining it into reality, if you will.
Well, that was, you know, that as I was saying before, when I couldn't shake this image, I started jotting notes down and sketching characters out. And then once I started doing that, then it started taking me to this place, you know, just a little bit south of Jackson. And then and all of a sudden the characters started appearing. And then, you know, I started seeing the faces. And I did a very general sort of outline. But then, that's why I brought in Dr. Bray. She once counseled me. She said, never make an outline too specific or too hard because you want to know, you want to give the story a chance to take you to new places, explore new ideas. And so then I saw the main character, Virgil, which is, you know, kind of based, I use the name because, Virgil led Dante through, you know, through hell, that sort of thing. But there are a lot of layers to the story, but then and then my background started coming in, and it's like, well, wait a second, you know, this musician then, and so I brought my years in Paris into play, and so it's like a compilation of things I've actually experienced, but also ideas I wanted to put into the book, I thought, well, you know, I was cross-bused, you know, I was one of the first, I was literally in the first wave of integration here in the South, and my own self-discovery, this incredible culture that I lived with but never participated in, and now suddenly, I had these wonderful black teachers, black friends, or whatever, and I discovered, it's like, my word, you know, this is such a rich culture. You know, why is this war between the races? And so It was very cathartic. I'm being long-winded, but the book was I got a lot out that I've always felt, and then arranged the story to make a lot of these points. But then a lot of times I just sat back, and it was almost like I was taking notes or dictation, I should say, from these characters. Because once it got to a point, I was like, every time I turned a corner, there was a new set of characters. I literally saw the places, and when I was in my study, I could hear the voices. It was just a wonderful experience. It took me about, all told, about 4 years, from each rewrite, and I would get feedback from an editor, and then it really wasn't polished off until it took almost 4 years, and I kind of missed that time. It may sound odd because I know I'll never go back and write a book about, the same place, probably. I might. I know you'd recommended maybe writing a book about one of the characters, which is actually very interesting. I hadn't thought about that. But it was just, it was a wonderful experience in learning a lot about myself, and then also, the world around me, because it's, that's what I love about writing, is it's, I think it was, I'm trying to remember who it was, who once said that, it's a shame you can't go back and, once you finish the book, you go back and look at it and say, well, I wish I could have done it a different way, but you've moved down the road so much that you got to keep moving on and write another book, because you always, it changes you. And this book changed me quite a bit, and I hope the reader will experience the same thing.
I was interested in a comment that you made, and actually it was a comment made by your mentor. I myself am a writer, albeit of just short articles, and I tend to find that, I'll sit down with an idea. It might be a phrase. And oftentimes it's not even a full sentence, and the story writes itself. Rarely do I come out with an end product that I expected.
Right.
Have Angel's Oracle mapped out before putting pen to paper, or did it just sort of emerge and morph as you wrote?
That would be closer to it. Is that it's like you take off and you're on this journey, and it just kept it's almost like the river. It kept turning and morphing, as you were saying. And really, I almost had to stop myself at times. There was another artist I was talking to one time. They said sometimes the trick is knowing when to stop, because you can put too much in. But it was very much. I had a sense of what was going to happen, but I was really surprised in the manner in which it all took place, if that makes any sense. In other words, I had a really good idea of like a beginning, middle, and end, but by the end of the book, which isn't giving away too much, there's a father talking to one of his sons, and that was the most, and it finishes off the book. It's a speech about human relations and how anger pervades human relationships, has and perhaps always will, unless we break the cycle. And that was the thing that floored me more than anything, is that was, I didn't see that one coming. It was only until I had gotten to that point in the story, and it's in this voice, the father talking to his son, and I thought, wow, and so had I tried to map this out on a very strict line, I don't think that would have come to me. And that's why I really believe keeps, that's the fascination of writing, is it's just discovery. It's like you're mining your own subconscious. All these, that gets back to what I was talking about with Jung, he claimed that really it was the subconscious that predominates, that, the conscious is just kind of off to the side, and that if you don't keep the two in balance, that's when you have problems, which I kind of get into in the book too. But again, being a little too long-winded here, but yes, it's Very much so. That's what that's what fuels the discipline of writing. Is if it wasn't some sort of journey of self-discovery and all discovering new things about the world, I don't see how anybody, at least for, I'm just speaking for myself, I don't think I could sit down every day and write, because I know at the end of the day, at the end of the session, I'm going to have something new that I never thought of, or it's in the paper, or I've written it in a way that I thought, wow, this is going to lead me to something else. So it's very much, I think loose outlines are good, but that's Dr. Bray, was, she always counseled me. She said, never get too tight with this. She was she's very close to Camus, and we used to talk about when he was writing, and that was one of the things that he would do. So that I figured that was pretty good advice.
What sort of reader feedback are you getting?
I have been really, really happy. I've gotten some wonderful reviews, very touching. I've actually had one woman just come up and just really excited. There have been some posted on Amazon.com that have just been wonderful. It's all been very positive, and it's slowly catching fire. The more people find out about it and find out what the subject matter is, they're anxious to read it. You know, I do have a website. It's BolickNovel.com, and there are two fairly long excerpts there that you can read that kind of give you a pretty decent entree into the book. So, yeah, I'm excited. I feel as though if people will just get the book in their hands and read it, they'll reading, that's asking a lot. I mean, in this day and time, there's so much to do. So I really feel as though you won't be wasting your time when you read this book. I think you can read it for the politics, for the mythology, for the love story. I mean, it has a little bit of everything in there. So I don't think the reader will be disappointed. I think every type of reader will find something they'll like about the book. Very happy.
Go back for a second, it clearly is available on Amazon.com.
Oh yes, and any search engine on the internet, any bookstore, you can walk into any bookstore in the United States and order it. It won't be on the shelves, but as soon as you order it, if you want the hard copy of it, they'll mail it to your house, and it's also offered as an ebook. I know a lot of people have Kindles out there, and if you want to save a little money, it's usually only like $3 with your ebook. So it's definitely worth a few bucks to sample, and it's available everywhere. And
okay, and just one more time, what is the website?
I'm sorry, yes, it's www.bolick, my last name, novel.com. So you can just Google, you can really just Google my name if you don't remember that website, and it should list it for you. But it's bolicknovel.com, and it will also send you to, there's a really nice video on YouTube now. It's a book trailer, which I don't know where they found it, but they found somebody who, that's the person I had in mind, the main character, Virgil. He's in the video, and the music is beautiful, they found a photograph of a town. I was astounded when they sent the trailer to me for approval. I just said yes, yes, yes. I mean, it was they got it right.
I'm a book reviewer, not a book critic. In fact, the surefire way to get a good dose of abuse out of me is refer to me as a critic. You know, however, there are aspects of a book that I look at with eyes that maybe the average reader does not. Mm-hmm. And character development is definitely a factor. And I think you develop your characters in a very skillful way. Are you happy the way they turned out?
Well, I appreciate you saying that. Yes, very much so. Most of my work is character driven, and I feel as though the story will follow in line. But I know with myself, I'm always fascinated by people, you know, just what's going on in their lives or whatever. And the story tends to follow an interesting character. I think it was Twain once said that he'd already met every character he'd written about on the river, you know, when he was a riverboat pilot. And I work in the airline industry. In some ways, I feel the same way. As I'm actually just pulling bits and pieces. And a lot of times when I hear a voice or have an idea, I've met so many different people and worked with so many different jobs that that's how I do it. And it's just I just start building the character. And then once I've built a character, I thought, well, okay, why have I built a character in such a way? And then the story, you know, tends to follow that character. And I appreciate you pointing that out, because then it allows for so much more layering in the book. I can then take it, okay, well, then if this character is fashioned in this way, well, obviously, you know, he did something else other than what he's doing in this story. And then I can pull in other ideas and other levels. And so suddenly you have a character, you know, even though it's a short space of time, when the reader encounters this character, they're seeing like a whole other life develop within that, even though it might be a minor character in the story. And so, that's always been to me the fascinating thing about writing is you are sort of this voyeur. You're allowing the reader to step inside of all these people's brains and see them when, you know, at their best and at their worst. And so, yes, character development to me is that's the first and foremost thing I do is, and then,
Virgil, he has this wonderful aura of goodness.
Yeah.
Maybe almost bordering on naivety.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, he's just... you want to reach out and, you know, give him a hug.
You know, that was the idea. I mentioned earlier that it was Virgil who led Dante through hell, and that was one of the ideas, is you have to have somebody who can make the trip through. And it really is for him sort of a hell. He loses his brother, you know, which we talk about. I don't want to give too much of the story away. He has a son, you know, that he has never seen, who's in France. So that, but yet he never gives up. And that was the idea. And he's actually, I will be honest, I mean, he may end up in another novel someplace, because he's very much at the, you know, I don't want to give too much away, but... he and the other character, Jez, very much could end up in another novel because of the way the story's structured. So may see him again.
Yeah. I'm going to come back to that idea. But the other character that I want to pick on is Billy. I mean, Billy is the work of sheer genius. I mean, his fall from grace is rather like watching a train crash in slow motion.
Well, you're very kind to say that. And I want to thank you for the spot-on visual that you used in your review of Munch's The Scream, because it's very much what's going on inside of Billy. And you put a picture to it, and I really appreciate that. And I hope when people read your review and the book, they'll have that image, because that's exactly. I mean, he is at war with himself, and so that was what I was trying to show, that all, you know, all good is not completely good, and all evil is not completely evil. There's a side of Billy that you actually will tug at your heartstrings just for a second, you know, but. You can't.
Yeah, it won't be for long.
Won't be for long, but yeah. You know, I mean, you know, believe me. But yes, that. I mean, I didn't want to make him, you know, just, you know, like something out of, you know, out of medieval times, of just completely, totally evil. I mean, there's a reason why he ended up the way he did, and I don't want to say too much because I don't want to spoil it for the readers. But I appreciate you bringing him up, because he is. He's very, well, he is the central, you know, he is the center of the novel, really, because through him you see what I was trying to show racism. Is he's really his racism is really a part of something inside of him that he projects outward onto the most available victim, so to speak. And so you know, that's another line I try to show in the book, is that is what is racism, the nature of it. And I don't think it's just as simple as skin color. I think there are reasons why it persists, because and again, I don't want to give away too much, but Billy, yeah, he's he was in fact, my editor after he said so you probably shouldn't be angry about anything. You've probably gotten it all out with this one character, because and you know, he was a little taken aback by him too, but yeah, he's the one who you know, he's the engine of the novel. Without, you know, I mean, from the moment he appears, I mean, that was the idea, was he was even when he's not in the room, you kind of feel his presence. So
right. You mentioned that, you know, you might possibly consider bringing Virgil and Jazz back in a future novel. And I'm just thinking off the top of my head here. I can see it already, all right? It would be Virgil and Jazz talking about their past, and the novel would transition into a wonderful story about Tom Burley.
There, yeah, exactly. And also, it's interesting you mentioned that too. And also, with Jez and Virgil together, I mean, they also with the Tom Burley, you know, they could bring Virgil's son into this too. I mean, because you know, finding him, and then wanting to know his background, and then the Tom Burley would come in, and then you would see a young Tom Burley and how he got to that point. So yeah, it was like I mean, it's always, something's always in the back of my mind, but yeah, it's the novel's there. It's just if I had the, you know, the time and the opportunity to write it, I would, because it was very much, as I said before, earlier in the conversation, at some point in time you have to stop yourself, because then you're going to ruin what you already have. And had I continued the novel on, I think it would have dragged it down. I mean, this was the perfect length, and you knew just enough about these characters. And so now, if I was going to say any more, I needed to pick it up in another novel.
Oh, indeed. Yeah. I mean, I think that you did an excellent job of, you know, using the right number of words, shall we say. You know, you leave the reader with a number of questions and an endless number of opportunities.
Well, that's it. It's interesting you say that, because that was one of the ideas I had when I wrote this, was the whole idea behind Angel's Oracle. I also wanted to give the reader the idea this is like an oral history too. And so that was one of the reasons why there is there are different people talking, different dialects. And, you know, I want it to be almost like there's, and you mentioned sitting on your front porch. Well, it's almost like, too, you know, I want people like they've heard this, you know. I know they have to read it, but, like, I wanted the sound of it to be like, because that's very Southern, you know, sitting around the porch and listening to, you know, your grandfather, great-grandfather tell these stories or whatever. That's part of it. My great uncle had a huge farm on the river. In fact, I even used his house. That was one of the images I had when I was developing the story. But I grew up going out there and listening to him, and we used to, you know, I would spend the weekend with him, and we'd get up at, you know, 3-4 o'clock in the morning, and go down to the river. He had this big pier built out on the river, and we would fish. And this man was born, you know, in 1900, and he would tell me all these stories. And we'd sit under this big willow tree and fish. And I have to credit with him with, you know, he's one of the biggest reasons why I probably ended up being a writer, because, my word, he was just, you know, it was story after story after story. He never finished high school, but just, it was this incredible storyteller. And that's part of Angel's Oracle too. It's just that oral Southern history that.
Off air, at least I think it was off air. You mentioned that you are working on another book. Can you, or would you like to share any information about that?
Well, it's I'm redirecting. I'd written it. I finished the first draft and sent it to my editor, the same editor I used with Angel's Oracle, and we went back and forth on it. And now I'm completely redirecting it, and I'm very excited about it. It's I'm having some of the same imagery and some of the same feelings I had when I wrote Angel's Oracle. But this one is written. This takes place, you know, in present time. And I'm really at the point now where I can't give away too much because I'm not sure exactly where it's going to go. Other than it's going to be there again. There's a whole line of mythology in there which reveals quite a bit about present day. And right now I'm leaning towards loosely based on the Odyssey and the idea that. I won't give too much away, but it's hopefully, you know, when Odysseus, you remember, he was trapped on the island with Calypso, and he was there for 10 years. Well, you know, and then Tennyson wrote about, well, you know, there's always been this question, well, you know, what did Odysseus do after he went back to Ithaca, you know, slayed the warriors they're trying to take over his household, you know, saw his son, you know, made good with his wife. Well, then he sails off again. So where is he going? What was it? Why did he leave again? And I had the idea that maybe he wanted to go back to that island to see Calypso again because he had such a good time. But that's just an idea I'm toying around with, and I'm I'm weaving that into to modern day. So let's see what happens.
Are you going to be picking on Mississippi again?
No. It's interesting you should say that because. The reason, one of the biggest reasons, it just from a historical standpoint, and also the Mississippi River, you know, it's just this huge river of commerce that there was just, you know, and it's just such a rich, and I'm a huge blues fan, and that's why that whole idea about music, and, you know, the birth of American, you know, the blues, jazz, everything, it just comes right out of the Mississippi Delta, so... But I hope I wasn't too rough on Mississippi because I really just enjoy so much of the history and the music, you know. But know that I don't, unless I, you know, if I get back to Virgil, yeah, that I'll definitely be back there. But not right now. Actually, the book I'm working on now is set in North Carolina. So.
But they're going to have wanted posters up for you.
Yeah. I'm afraid you're right. I'm afraid I might have that sheriff chasing me next time I'm there.
That's right. I think of you know, books as being a three-phased issue, and it gets harder with each step. It's really hard to write the darn thing in the first place.
Yeah.
And then it's harder still to publish it.
Yep.
And then you come up against the dreaded M word, marketing.
Yes.
What are you doing in the way of marketing? Are you doing book signings, that kind of activity?
Well, I've done some book signings, and also I'm working with a PR firm, which they're circulating several articles about me and the book, trying to drum up interest and just really get the word out. And that's the thing is, I think if people just find out about the subject matter in the book, I think they'll be interested enough to want to read it. And of course, you know, everywhere I go, I'm talking it up and doing my own little, promotional shtick. But I don't have the answer. You know, it's just it's as you were saying, it's the dreaded M. You know, how do you market? It's just in this day and time, it's just we're just saturated with with, you know, on the internet and on TV. How do you, you know, kind of nuzzle your way up to the front to just let people know about it? That's the key. So I'm hoping with a few more reviews, and if some people will read the article, you know, it's beginning to circulate, that'll create enough interest that maybe this will catch fire for me.
Well, I sincerely hope so. My producer is whining in my ear. we're just about out of time. I really, really want to thank you for taking time out to talk with us today. And I know I speak for everyone here at Blogger News in wishing you every success with Angel's Oracle. And I do hope that I will get a peek at whatever is going to become in the future.
Well, you'll be one of the first, Simon. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and you will be one of the first to, whenever a new book comes out, I would love for you to read it, and you'd be one your top on my list. So I look forward to it.
Okay. I have to close now. Gary, again, thank you. This is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a happy and safe President's Day. And we will be back again soon. Till next time, goodbye.
Thank you, Simon.